Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today we're embarking on what feels like a really crucial exploration.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to help unpack the layers of information with you.
Today we're doing our deep dive into the federal news update for Wednesday, August 13th, 2025. And look, this isn't just about skimming headlines, is it?
No, not at all. It's really about understanding the complex web of actions, the decisions, everything that shaped August 12th, 2025, across the U.S. federal government.
Exactly. Our mission today for you is to give a thorough, comprehensive, really exhaustive report. We want granular detail on each and every action, every activity from that single day.
And we'll explore not just the immediate impacts, but, you know, the broader strategic implications. What does it mean for the nation? What does it mean for the world?
August 12th was, well, it was brimming with significant activity, wasn't it? Especially from the executive branch.
Oh, absolutely. It really provides a compelling snapshot. Mm-hmm. You see an administration executing what seems to be a coherent and, frankly, quite assertive strategic agenda.
We'll be examining how foreign policy, national security, domestic governance, how they were all impacted.
And how they connect. Because there's a fascinating interconnectedness just beneath the surface. You know?
Okay, so let's unpack this. Start right there with the executive branch, which really seemed to drive the day's most impactful developments.
Sounds good. Because beneath the surface, these actions, they might seem diverse, diplomacy here, finance there, but they reveal a surprisingly cohesive blueprint.
How so?
Well, it's all about prioritizing bilateral deal making,
yeah,
using economic leverage as a powerful geopolitical tool.
And applying federal power very directly.
Exactly. Directly applying federal power to push a very specific agenda. So let's delve into what that actually looked like on the ground on August 12th.
So the executive branch was buzzing. I mean, really buzzing with activity. Initiatives spanning global diplomacy, international economic statecraft, national defense, domestic policy. It felt like a full spectrum day.
That's a good way to put it. What we saw was an administration actively pulling on multiple levers of power all at once.
And these actions, as varied as they seem, you're saying they were interconnected.
Consistently interconnected, yeah.
Yeah.
By an underlying ideological approach. It was a day that perfectly showcased their preference for direct, often bilateral engagements.
A willingness to wield economic tools pretty aggressively, too.
Right. To achieve broader geopolitical ends, and as we said, a robust application of federal power to implement their specific policy priorities. We can peel back the layers on each of these.
Okay, starting with foreign policy. The State Department, the White House, they showed a clear preference for direct, almost leader-to-leader engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, that seemed to come at the expense of traditional multilateral consultation. Nowhere was this clearer than in the lead up to the U.S.-Russia summit.
Right. So on August 12th, the State Department confirmed Secretary of State Marco Rubio had that prep call with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
Setting the stage for the Trump-Putin summit.
Exactly. Now, what's particularly revealing here, and they made sure to note this explicitly in the briefing, is that the call to arrange this meeting initiated by President Putin.
Ah, that's a deliberate detail, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely deliberate. Yeah. It's meant to project an image of Russia seeking engagement, maybe even, you know, eager for this direct dialogue with the U.S. It's subtle, but it's significant messaging from the U.S. side.
And the context here is just critical. The ongoing brutal war in Ukraine hangs over everything.
Completely.
So the White House has been very deliberate in managing expectations, haven't they? Almost setting a remarkably low bar for what success looks like.
Extremely deliberate. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt called it just a listening exercise.
The listening exercise.
And President Trump himself referred to it as more of a feel-out meeting. You know, not a formal negotiation.
It sounds like they're trying to create a narrative where almost anything short of a complete diplomatic collapse can be spun as a win.
That's exactly it. I mean, think about it. This framing provides immense political flexibility for the administration.
How so?
Well, any agreement, no matter how minor, can then be painted as a significant success, something that exceeded these modest public goals.
And if nothing happens?
Conversely, if there's no progress or the talks fall apart, it can easily be blamed on Russian intransigence or just the sheer difficulty of the issues. No real political fallout for the president. It's a clever way to ensure a win-win in the public story, regardless of what actually happens behind closed doors.
But then these carefully managed public statements, they seem to clash with some of the president's own earlier remarks, which makes it even more complicated.
Right. He had previously suggested a deal could be imminent.
even floating that highly controversial idea of some swapping of territories.
Which Ukrainian President Zelensky has firmly, consistently rejected. It's utterly unacceptable for Kyiv.
This kind of contradictory messaging, especially on something so sensitive, it must generate a lot of anxiety, right, among allies.
Absolutely. It has generated considerable anxiety among NATO partners. You can almost feel the fear.
What are they worried about specifically?
Their fear is a bilateral U.S.-Russia deal, maybe brokered without their direct involvement, or worse, completely ignoring Ukraine's position. That could fundamentally undermine Ukrainian sovereignty.
And essentially reward Russian aggression.
Exactly. It's a major point of friction, a source of deep unease. It could potentially strain the transatlantic alliance at a really critical moment.
And this seems to point to an underlying doctrine, doesn't it? This whole approach.
It does. The decision to push ahead with these high-level bilateral talks, even with allied concerns, seems indicative of a core belief in this administration's foreign policy.
Which is?
A profound belief in personal top-level diplomacy. The idea that leaders talking directly can achieve breakthroughs where traditional, maybe multilateral processes have stalled or just too slow.
It's a high-risk, high-reward gamble.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Betting that a direct deal between leaders can override complex geopolitics and maybe even long-standing alliances.
And the sequencing is telling, too, isn't it? Who gets briefed when?
Incredibly telling. The administration explicitly stated they plan to brief President Zelensky and European leaders after the meeting with President Putin.
After? Not before or during?
After. That order clearly underscores the primacy of direct engagement with Moscow. It positions the U.S. as the lead negotiator, almost acting unilaterally on the world stage.
Even if it leaves allies feeling sidelined, informed rather than consulted.
Precisely. Which begs the question, how does this play out globally? Does it risk isolating the U.S. from traditional partners? Or is it a calculated gamble for a breakthrough few thought possible?
It certainly sounds like a very deliberate, maybe even isolating, diplomatic strategy, prioritizing direct talks, even if it causes friction elsewhere. Okay, so beyond Russia, the State Department briefing on August 12th also went out of its way to highlight the administration's stated role as a global peacemaker.
Mm-hmm. They showcased the recent joint declaration for peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan, hosted by President Trump at the White House.
Presented as a landmark achievement, something only President Trump could deliver. Strong language.
Very strong. But then, the spokesperson, Tammy Bruce, rolled out this list of other so-called negotiated peace arrangements.
Right, I saw that. Cambodia and Thailand, Rwanda and DRC, India and Pakistan.
Egypt and Ethiopia, Serbia and Kosovo, the Abraham Accords, and, wait for it, Israel and Iran.
Israel and Iran. That one definitely raises eyebrows.
Right. If you're listening closely, that should make your ears perk up. Hmm. That's not just rhetoric. It's a bold, almost audacious attempt to build a narrative.
A narrative of the president as a uniquely effective global dealmaker.
Exactly. Perhaps even manufacturing successes where, let's be honest, reality hasn't quite caught up yet. That list seems less about strict factual accuracy and much more about rhetorical impact. It serves a very specific political purpose.
It feels strategic, almost like political theater.
It is strategic. This narrative provides a crucial positive counterpoint to the difficult, unresolved Ukraine conflict. It suggests the president's unconventional methods work where others fail.
It reinforces that strong leader image, too.
Which is central to the administration's brand, absolutely. Mm. It justifies the often unconventional unilateral style by pointing to a record of tangible successes,
yeah,
even if they're, let's say, selectively presented. It's all about shaping perception, both at home and abroad.
It's about controlling the narrative.
Entirely.
Yeah.
And then, contrasting sharply with those grand declarations, we saw a more routine diplomatic action happen at the same time.
What was that?
The administration expressed condolences for the death of Colombian Senator Uribe. They announced Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau would go to Bogota for the memorial services.
So standard diplomatic protocol.
Right. A seemingly small gesture, but it maintains those traditional protocols, signals continued U.S. engagement with a key partner in the hemisphere. It's a reminder that not all diplomacy is high-stakes, narrative-driven stuff. A lot of it is just maintaining relationships, adhering to norms.
It's a striking contrast, though. The headline-grabbing announcements alongside the quiet, essential diplomatic work shows the State Department operating on very different levels simultaneously. Okay, let's shift to navigating complexities in the Middle East and South Asia. August 12th revealed some interesting, maybe even contradictory, dynamics there, too. Iraq, for instance.
Right. In Iraq, the State Department voiced strong opposition to an Iraqi parliamentary bill about the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMF.
Why the opposition?
They view it as something that would significantly increase Iranian influence, effectively turning Iraq into, quote, an Iranian satellite state. Strong words.
But what's the reality on the ground?
Oh, well, this is where it gets illuminating. The same briefing also had to address the undeniable reality. A recent visit to Baghdad by a top Iranian security official.
Who did what?
Who signed a new security agreement with the Iraqi government.
Ah, so a direct contradiction.
An immediate juxtaposition. It highlights the significant gap between U.S. policy objectives, what the State Department wants, and its apparent, often limited, ability to actually influence outcomes in Baghdad. It shows a persistent disconnect between American diplomatic rhetoric and the complex, often intractable, realities on the ground.
And what about Gaza? What was the administration's line on August 12th?
The stated position was primarily working toward a ceasefire, mainly for humanitarian aid. They framed it by asserting that Hamas has been at war with the people of Gaza, calling Gazans the first victims.
But there was more to it, right? A dual call.
Yes, a dual call. On one hand, the U.S. called on Israel to investigate the killing of Palestinian journalists. On the other hand, they also noted, as they often do, that Hamas has historically embedded its members within civilian society. A very delicate balancing act.
Trying to address multiple concerns at once.
It is. A difficult tightrope walk, balancing humanitarian concerns, press freedom, and the harsh realities of urban warfare. And that same kind of delicate balance extends to South Asia. We saw another interesting dynamic there. The administration announced a new U.S.-Pakistan counterterrorism dialogue, both nations reaffirming a shared commitment to fighting terrorism.
Which seems like pragmatic engagement.
It is. It's a necessity for regional stability and counterterrorism ops. But this exists in direct tension with the administration's simultaneous action, applying economic pressure on India, Pakistan's chief rival.
Right, the tariffs we'll get to. That seems like a very siloed approach to diplomacy. Almost like these regional strategies aren't fully talking to each other.
You're hitting on a critical point. This pattern addressing Iraq, Syria, Gaza, Pakistan, each in its own distinct diplomatic silo, without an obvious overarching regional strategy, it can lead to significant policy contradictions.
And unintended consequences.
Absolutely. It clearly shows the challenges of trying to manage these interlocking geopolitical conflicts through a purely bilateral transactional framework. You risk one action undermining another or creating new problems while trying to solve old ones. The left hand might not always know what the right hand is doing, strategically speaking.
So this seems like a recurring theme then, U.S. policy goals versus the complex realities on the ground, leading to a complex, sometimes contradictory foreign policy. It shows how tough it is to project influence effectively in these regions. Now, let's turn to something significant, though maybe subtly presented, a shift in how the U.S. engages with human rights globally. This was signaled by the release of the State Department's 2024 Human Rights Report on August 12th. Mm-hmm. The administration claimed a major restructuring. Spokesperson Tammy Bruce said it was to remove redundancy, increase readability, and be responsive to legislative mandates, rather than an expansive list of politically biased demands and assertions. That sounds like bureaucratic shuffling, but is it more than that?
Oh, it's much more. Don't be fooled by the restructuring label. This isn't just streamlining. It's a profound ideological pivot.
Explain that.
Well, for decades, the power of that report, diplomatically speaking, came from its comparative benchmark, its grounding in universal human rights norms. It used rankings as a critical naming and shaming tool.
Right. Countries were ranked against each other.
Exactly. By eliminating those rankings and reframing the entire report around narrow legislative mandates, the administration is deliberately moving away from that universalist, norms-based approach. It's a fundamental ideological shift disguised as a procedural tweak.
So what are the real-world implications of getting rid of the rankings and this restructuring? It sounds like it could significantly change how the U.S. is perceived and how it acts on human rights.
The implications are significant, yeah, and quite far-reaching. First, it diminishes the report's usefulness in multilateral diplomacy. It blunts its edge as a tool for international pressure.
Because there's no comparison anymore.
Right. It also directly reduces pressure on autocratic regimes because they're no longer being publicly ranked against others. This aligns perfectly with the administration's broader preference for transactional strategic interests over focusing on a country's internal governance systems.
So it makes it easier to deal with countries that have poor human rights records.
Essentially, yes. It allows deals to be pursued without the, let's say, diplomatic inconvenience of a highly critical public assessment from its own State Department. It strategically reshapes a key foreign policy tool to better fit a nationalist, interest-based ideology. It potentially signals a less robust U.S. stance on universal human rights going forward.
That sounds like a really significant redefinition, prioritizing other interests and almost lowering the volume on traditional human rights advocacy. A major shift. Okay, let's move to economic statecraft. August 12th put this on full display. Tariffs? Sanctions used not just as trade policy, but as potent tools. Tools to pressure competitors, disrupt illicit networks, even reshape domestic finance. Let's start with their reciprocal tariff doctrine, especially how it was applied so differently to China versus India.
Right. On the China front, we saw an executive order continuing the suspension of previously announced reciprocal tariffs on a whole range of goods from the PRC.
They paused those tariffs.
Yeah, the suspension was set to expire on August 12th, but they extended it until November 10th, 2025. The stated reason was to allow for ongoing discussions with the PRC to address the lack of trade reciprocity.
So keep talking and the tariffs stay off.
Basically, it's a tactical de-escalation, using temporary relief as a powerful bargaining chip. The implicit threat to China is crystal clear. These tariffs will be reinstated, maybe even escalated, if the talks don't yield results favorable to the U.S. It's a strategic pause, definitely not a change of heart.
So a classic carrot and stick. But then, in total contrast, a separate executive order slapped new punitive tariffs on India. That really jumped out.
It absolutely should have. This order specifically imposed an additional ad valorem duty on imports of articles of India, which is directly or indirectly importing Russian Federation oil.
Wow. Okay, so hitting India for buying Russian oil.
Exactly. The rationale explicitly links it to the national emergency declared back in Executive Order 14066 concerning Russia's actions in Ukraine. This is textbook secondary sanctions. Meaning, the U.S. isn't just targeting the primary adversary, Russia. It's penalizing a third country, India, for doing business with them. It's basically telling the world, if you help our adversary undermine our sanctions, you'll pay a price too, even if you're a partner like India. It's a significant extension of U.S. economic coercion.
Looking at these two actions together, easing off China, hitting India, it suggests a particular view of tariffs, doesn't it? It's definitely not just about balancing trade deficits.
Not at all. Yeah. These two moves reveal tariffs are seen not as stable trade policy, but as dynamic, flexible tools of statecraft. Tools for immediate foreign policy goals.
Inducements or punishments.
Exactly. Inducements for China, offering a reprieve. Punishments for India, enforcing geopolitical goals related to Russia. This inherently creates volatility for international trade, for global supply chains. It's about weaponizing U.S. market access.
And potentially straining relationships in the process.
Definitely. Potentially straining key relationships, like with India, which is crucial in the Indo-Pacific. It's high-stakes economic diplomacy, using tariffs like a switch that can be flipped on or off depending on the immediate goal.
So tariffs as a flexible, high-stakes lever, almost like a diplomatic weapon rather than just economic policy. Okay, beyond tariffs, the administration also used sanctions to target illicit finance, specifically focusing on conflict minerals in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC. This always feels like such a complex, tragic issue.
It is complex and critically important. The Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, announced new sanctions on August 12th, targeting entities tied to the violence and illicit trade in conflict minerals in the DRC.
Remind us why these minerals are so important.
Well, the DRC is a primary global source of things like coltan, cobalt, tungsten minerals, absolutely essential for modern electronics. Your smartphone, EV batteries, laptops, they all rely on these.
But the trade fuels conflict.
Tragically, yes. It has fueled brutal conflict for decades. Armed groups fund their operations by controlling mines, imposing illegal taxes, engaging in widespread smuggling. It's a horrific cycle.
And these new sanctions, they went beyond just the armed groups themselves, right? They targeted the whole network.
Precisely. That's key. They specifically targeted an armed group, the Coalition des Patriotes Résistants Congolais Force de Frappe, or PERCO-FF, cited for controlling mining sites, illegal fees, smuggling, and severe human rights abuses, forced labor, civilian executions.
But also the commercial side.
Crucially, yes. They also targeted the commercial network enabling this trade. A Congolese mining company, Cooperative des Artisanaux Miniers du Congo, CDMC, for allegedly selling smuggled minerals. And significantly, two Hong Kong-based exporters, East Rice Corporation and Star Dragon Corporation, for buying these illicit minerals.
Okay, targeting Hong Kong purchasers. Now, while this is framed as combating human rights abuses, corruption, It also seems to serve a pretty clear strategic purpose in the great power competition context. It's not just about human rights, is it?
Not at all. This is where it gets really interesting strategically. By targeting those downstream purchasers in Hong Kong, the U.S. directly disrupts a supply chain, funneling critical minerals towards China.
China needs those minerals for its tech industry.
Absolutely. So this move attempts to create a kind of bifurcated global market. On one side, a clean supply chain, compliant with U.S. sanctions, accessible to Western companies. On the other, a tainted one, carrying huge legal, financial, reputational risk for anyone involved.
And the stated goal.
The stated goal, per Treasury Undersecretary John Hurley, is to disrupt a trade, exacting a deadly toll on Congolese civilians, fueling corruption, and preventing law-abiding businesses from investing. So this action simultaneously advances a human rights agenda while pursuing the national economic security objective of developing critical mineral sources not controlled by a primary strategic competitor, China.
It's a textbook example of leveraging economic tools for both ethical and strategic geopolitical ends.
Exactly. It's fascinating how a human rights initiative can also be such a sharp strategic economic move. Highlights the deep interconnectedness of these global issues.
Okay, let's move to the domestic front. The Federal Register published three new executive orders on August 12th, signed by President Trump a few days earlier on the 7th. These orders really show a concerted effort to reshape domestic financial and regulatory policy using executive authority. That's a powerful tool.
Extremely powerful. The first, Executive Order 14331, titled Guaranteeing Fair Banking for All Americans, tackles what it calls politicized or unlawful debanking.
Debanking. What's the focus there?
The order's text is explicitly political. It cites examples where banks allegedly targeted customers for surveillance based on transactions involving terms like Trump or MAGA, or purchases from places like Cabela's or Base Pro Shop.
So targeting based on political affiliation or related purchases.
That's the claim. The order directs federal banking regulators to remove reputation risk as a basis for examination and to take action against institutions found engaging in debanking based on political or religious beliefs.
What's the effect of that?
It effectively weaponizes financial regulation to shield the administration's political allies and supporters from perceived discrimination by banks. It frames access to banking as a potent culture war issue. It's a direct assertion of federal power dictating how financial institutions should operate.
So using federal muscle to push back on perceived bias in finance, what about the second order? This one deals with 401ks, which affects millions of people's retirement savings.
Right. The second one, EO 14330, democratizing access to alternative assets for 401k investors, is a major policy shift, potentially huge implications.
What does it do?
Its goal is to make it easier for employer-sponsored retirement plans, like 401k, to invest in what are called alternative assets.
Define alternative assets.
Broadly defined here to include private equity, private debt, real estate, digital assets like crypto, and commodities, things not typically found in standard 401ks.
And how does the order facilitate this?
It directs the Secretary of Labor to re-examine and clarify guidance on fiduciary duties under ERISA. That's the big law governing retirement plans. The goal is to curb litigation risks for the plan managers, the fiduciaries, if they offer funds with these alternative assets. Make them less scared of being sued for offering them.
Okay, what's the big picture rationale here? Why push these alternative assets into 401ks?
Well, this policy change aims to unlock trillions of dollars currently sitting in retirement savings, making it available for investment in higher risk, often higher fee, private markets.
Who benefits most from that?
This has been a long-standing goal of the private equity and asset management industries. They stand to gain significantly from access to this massive pool of capital.
And the risks for ordinary savers.
For ordinary Americans, it introduces new risks. Private equity, for example, often has much less transparency than public stocks. It's less liquid, harder to sell quickly. And it usually involves higher management fees. This represents a major potential shift in how average Americans' retirement savings are invested, potentially exposing them to less regulated, more volatile asset classes.
That's a significant potential change for everyday investors, and the third executive order from that batch.
Executive Order 14332, Improving Oversight of Federal Grantmaking. This one directs federal agencies to give senior political appointees more authority to review and approve discretionary grants.
Why? What's the stated goal?
The stated aim is to ensure these grants align better with administration priorities and the national interest. It also explicitly authorizes terminating grants that, in the view of the appointee, no longer serve agency goals.
So tighter political control over grant money.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
It gives political appointees a much tighter grip on the flow of billions in federal funding.
Okay. Looking at these three EOs together, banking, 401k, grants, they paint a very clear picture, don't they? It's not just random policymaking.
Absolutely not random. Taken together, they illustrate a clear strategy, using executive power to reorient the administrative state in very specific ways.
To achieve what?
Well, they aim to reward political supporters by addressing perceived grievances, like the debanking issue. They advance the economic interests of favored industries, like private equity getting access to 401k. And they ensure that the vast flow of federal grant money aligns directly with the administration's ideological agenda.
It's a comprehensive effort.
A comprehensive effort to reshape how the federal government interacts with the economy and its various stakeholders. Centralizing control, ensuring resources flow towards desired outcomes, all using the power of the executive order.
So using executive power to reshape financial landscapes, the flow of federal funds, very strategic moves indeed. Touching everything from banking access to retirement savings to research grants, a powerful demonstration of direct executive authority. All right, let's switch gears to national security and defense modernization. The Department of Defense had some truly significant actions on August 12th, especially a landmark technological advancement in space. This sounds almost like science fiction, but it's very real.
It is real, and it's a huge deal, a major milestone for the U.S. Space Force and the Department of the Air Force. The successful launch of the Navigation Technology Satellite 3, or NTS-3.
From Cape Canaveral.
From Cape Canaveral Space Force Station, yes. Now, this isn't just another satellite. It's designated a Vanguard program. That means it's cutting edge.
How so?
NTS-3 is the DoD's first experimental integrated navigation satellite in nearly 50 years. It's a critical step toward fundamentally modernizing the nation's positioning, navigation, and timing capabilities, PNT.
Which is basically GPS and related tech.
Exactly. And PNT is absolutely foundational, not just for modern warfare, but for the global economy, too. Everything from banking to farming relies on it.
And the launch itself was significant, too.
Yes, it was also the first national security mission for United Launch Alliance's new Vulcan rocket, successfully validating that vehicle for future critical payloads. That signals a new era for space launches as well.
So what's the main purpose of NTS-3? What makes it so important, and how is it different from the GPS we all use every day?
Okay, the primary purpose is to experiment with and demonstrate a whole suite of advanced technologies. The goal is to make GPS much more robust, more resilient, more responsive to 21st century threats.
What kind of threats?
We're talking specifically about electronic warfare tactics, things like signal jamming and spoofing, especially from peer adversaries like China and Russia. These tactics could cripple military operations, disrupt civilian infrastructure.
So NTS-3 is designed to counter that.
Precisely. The satellite will operate in a near geosynchronous orbit for a one-year demonstration mission. It'll conduct over 100 experiments to rigorously test these new capabilities against real-world conditions.
Okay, so NTS-3 sounds like much more than just a simple upgrade. What's the real game changer here? What's the core innovation that truly sets it apart from older GPS satellites?
The key innovation, the real leap forward, lies in its fully reprogrammable software-defined architecture.
Software-defined, meaning?
Meaning it seamlessly integrates the space segment, the ground control, and the user equipment. Unlike legacy GPS satellites, which were basically launched with fixed hardware and capabilities you couldn't easily update, NTS-3 allows for rapid on-orbit software updates.
So you can update it from the ground after it's launched?
Exactly. This means new navigation signals can be developed and broadcast. New anti-jamming or anti-spoofing techniques can be deployed in response to emerging threats, all without needing to launch a new, incredibly expensive satellite. That agility is truly groundbreaking. It provides a critical advantage.
Are there other new technologies being tested?
Yes, several. Electronically steered phased array antennas that can focus PNT signals into specific geographic regions, making them stronger and harder to jam there. More precise atomic clocks for even greater accuracy. And a new signal authentication protocol called Chimera.
Chimera? What's that?
Think of Chimera as a highly secure digital handshake for satellite signals. It's designed to verify their authenticity and protect against sophisticated spoofing attacks, attacks that could potentially mislead military systems or even civilian navigation like aircraft.
Okay, connecting this to the bigger picture then. The NTS-3 launch isn't just a tech upgrade. You're saying it's a fundamental philosophical shift.
It really is. A shift in the U.S. military's approach to space assets. moving away from building static, hardened infrastructure towards prioritizing dynamic, adaptable systems.
Agility over just being tough.
Right. That agility aims to provide a significant, enduring strategic advantage in this escalating competition for superiority in space and the electromagnetic spectrum. Technologies proven by NTS-3 are expected to be incorporated into future GPS production lines, like the GPS SPY-S satellites and the broader resilient GPS architecture.
Ensuring PNT remains a decisive edge.
A decisive enabler for U.S. and allied forces, especially in contested environments where adversaries are actively trying to deny access. This is absolutely about staying ahead in a critical domain and anticipating the threats of tomorrow.
Okay, beyond the NTS-3 launch, the Defense Department also announced several major contracts on August 12th. These give us a real-time look at military procurement priorities, right? And show the DoD's huge role in sustaining the defense industrial base.
Absolutely. The largest single award announced that day went to Raytheon. $258.7 million for engineering, manufacturing, and development of the Standard Missile 2, the SM-2 Block ICU.
What kind of missile is that?
It's an advanced naval surface-to-air missile. This is a very significant investment, underscoring a continued focus on high-end conventional deterrence, particularly in the maritime domain. These missiles are crucial for protecting Navy ships from advanced aerial threats like aircraft and anti-ship missiles.
And it was sole-sourced to Raytheon?
Yes, awarded on a sole-source basis. That highlights Raytheon's unique capability in this specialized area and really underscores the cutting-edge nature of the high-end defense industry. Only certain players can build these systems.
So, high-tech weaponry, clearly a priority. But what about other areas? Did the contract list show a broader defense strategy?
It did. Complementing the strategic importance of NTS-3, the Air Force also awarded a $15.6 million contract modification to a company called GEAST.
For what?
For developing space-based sensors designed to improve space domain awareness, or SDA, in geosynchronous orbit. That's where many critical satellites reside.
So knowing what's up there.
Exactly. Knowing what's up there, tracking potential threats. This highlights the DoD's dual-pronged space strategy. On one hand, hardening its own assets like GPS against attack, and on the other, significantly improving its ability to monitor what potential adversaries are doing in space. It's about seeing what's out there and protecting what's yours.
And the other contracts announced, do they really show the sheer breadth of the defense economy, like you mentioned?
They certainly do. It's fascinating, really. You look at the list, and it ranges from high-tech missiles to, well, uniforms.
Give us some examples.
Okay. Aramon Technologies, Inc. got $7.7 million for uninterruptible power supplies and bypass switches for Navy ships, absolutely essential infrastructure to keep vessels running. Loop Management Services, LLC, was awarded $50 million for base maintenance and sustainment at Joint Base Langley Eustis in Virginia, showing the ongoing need just to upkeep facilities. Matrix Research, Inc., was added to a nearly $95 million contract for science and technology applied radio frequency systems that's pushing the boundaries of things like electronic warfare. G&G Steel, Inc. got $18.1 million to fabricate and deliver an upstream miter gate for the Army Corps of Engineers that's critical civil infrastructure work, often with military applications.
Fueling sites, coats, and trousers.
Right. Tetra Tech, Inc. got a $9.1 million modification for recurring maintenance and repairs at fueling sites the military needs fuel to move. And Amagibet Manufacturing, LLC, received a $12.9 million modification to procure various coats and trousers for the Defense Logistics Agency, making sure service members are properly equipped.
So, taken together.
Taken together. These contracts show the sheer breadth and economic impact of the defense sector. They support a huge range of companies, large and small, providing capabilities essential for maintaining military readiness and operations. And they all connect back, in some way, to the overall strategic priorities we're seeing. It truly shows the vast ecosystem supporting national defense, far beyond just the headline-grabbing weapons.
It really does demonstrate that supporting national defense is a massive, complex undertaking, impacting everything from high-tech satellites to the clothes on soldiers' backs. Now, in a very significant assertion of federal power over a local jurisdiction, the administration took extremely direct steps on August 12th. Steps to address what it defined as a public safety crisis right here in the nation's capital. This was a major flashpoint.
It certainly was. On August 11th, President Trump signed Executive Order 14333, titled Declaring a Crime Emergency in the District of Columbia. It was set for publication in the Federal Register on August 13th.
A crime emergency. What was the justification given in the order?
The order asserts that special conditions of an emergency nature exist due to what it claims is rising crime in Washington, D.C. It states this urgently endangers public servants, citizens, and tourists, and disrupts the secure functioning of the federal government itself. It paints a picture of an immediate threat to the very seat of government.
And what authority did the president invoke for this? Because D.C. has its own local government, its own police force.
He invoked his authority under Section 740 of the District of Columbia Home Rule Act. This is a unique piece of legislation stemming from D.C.'s status as a federal district, not a state. It grants Congress, and by extension, the president, in certain circumstances, ultimate authority over the district.
So what did the order direct?
It directed that the services of the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, MPD, be made available for federal purposes. And it delegated operational control of MPD to the Attorney General, tasking the AG with directing the police force to maintain law and order and protect federal property.
And there was a military component, too?
Yes. Concurrently with the order, the administration announced the activation of 800 members of the D.C. National Guard, a very visible federal deployment on the streets of the Capitol.
How did local D.C. officials react to this?
Immediately and forcefully, they condemned it. D.C. Attorney General Brian Schwalb called the move unprecedented, unnecessary, and unlawful. He directly disputed the factual premise, stating flatly, there is no crime emergency in the District of Columbia.
They disputed the facts about crime rates.
Yes. Local officials pointed to data showing that violent crime in the city had actually been decreasing since a peak in 2023. So a very clear, very public disagreement over the basic facts on the ground.
This raises a big question then, doesn't it, about the true nature of this intervention?
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
The president's use of this emergency authority, while it might have a legal basis in D.C.'s unique status, represents a dramatic political escalation.
How so?
It transforms what is fundamentally a local issue, crime rates, into a national conflict. A conflict over home rule, over federalism, over differing approaches to public safety. And you have to consider the administration's rhetoric, too.
Like what?
The president's previous comments about the filth and the decay in the Capitol, his promise to clean it up. This frames the intervention in highly political terms, painting D.C. as this symbol of urban decay under Democratic leadership.
So it's not just about law enforcement. It sounds like it might be using D.C. as a stage for a national political message. What's the real goal beyond just policing?
Precisely. It suggests the action serves a powerful dual purpose. First, it allows the administration to project a strong, tough-on-crime image by taking direct, visible action in the nation's capital, fulfilling a campaign promise. Second, it simultaneously functions as a powerful political tool to sharply criticize the governance of the Democratic-led city.
So, less about just crime stats, more about politics.
It's best understood not merely as a law enforcement measure, but as a calculated political act. An act that uses the unique legal status of Washington, D.C. as a stage for a national debate on crime, governance, and federal versus local control.
So a local issue deliberately elevated to the national stage, highlighting these deep tensions about federalism, governance, and political narratives. A very potent demonstration of executive power used for both policy and political messaging. Okay, now in stark contrast to that flurry of executive actions we just dissected, the legislative branch, Congress, proceeded with much more, let's say, routine business on August 12th. It focused mainly on introducing new proposals, not immediate action. It really was a much slower drumbeat up on Capitol Hill.
Indeed, a very different rhythm. The House of Representatives was in session on August 12th, 2025. The official records show 26 new bills and resolutions were introduced by various members.
But no major votes or actions.
No. The legislative agenda for that day wasn't focused on floor votes or committee markups of major legislation. No bills were reported out of committee. No final passage votes were held. The House then adjourned until noon on Friday, August 15th.
Pretty typical for a midweek session.
Entirely typical, yeah. For a session not scheduled for major legislative pushes, it highlights the much more deliberate, often preparatory pace of Congress compared to the executive branch's capacity for immediate, sometimes sweeping, action. Congress often plays the longer game, laying groundwork, building consensus, or not.
One particular bill introduced that day, though, did stand out and seems worth focusing on, H.R. 4969. It's aimed directly at manufactured housing affordability. That touches on a very specific and often quite vulnerable population.
That's right. Among those 26 bills was H.R. 4969, sponsored by Representative Gabe Vasquez of New Mexico. The bill's official title is the Keep Mobile Homes Affordable Act. It was referred to the House Committee on Financial Services.
And its stated purpose?
The stated purpose is to direct the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development to investigate and report on the prices for pad sites in manufactured home communities and for other purposes. The other purposes is always where the details might lie.
Okay, what's the broader context here? What specific problem is this bill trying to get at, and why is federal intervention being called for now?
According to Representative Vasquez's office, the legislation is a direct response to a growing and, frankly, alarming trend. Large institutional investors, private equity firms, they're increasingly buying up manufactured housing communities, mobile home parks across the country.
And then what happens?
Once they own them, they often impose steep, sometimes predatory, increases in the lot rental fees on the residents, the fees for the piece of ground their home sits on.
Why is that particularly problematic?
This practice has been described by advocates as exploitative because it targets a uniquely vulnerable population. Many residents are low income, elderly, on fixed incomes. They often own their physical manufactured home, but critically, they don't own the land underneath it.
So they're stuck if the rent goes up drastically.
Exactly. The cost of moving a manufactured home is incredibly high, estimated around $6,000 or more. That often makes it financially impossible for residents to simply pick up and leave. It effectively leaves them captive to run hikes that can force devastating choices between paying the rent and affording food, medicine, or utilities.
So what's the proposed solution in this bill to try and counteract that trend?
The bill proposes requiring federal regulatory review, presumably by HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. This review would kick in for any investor purchasing a portfolio of over 2,500 mobile homes or pads.
What would the review aim to do?
The aim would be to prevent price gouging and also ensure that essential utilities and services are actually maintained within these communities after they're bought up.
Connecting this to the bigger picture, then.
If we connect this, the introduction of H.R. 4969 really sheds light on a significant and often overlooked dimension of the national housing affordability crisis. It signals that this financialization of niche housing markets like mobile home parks has reached a scale where local and state consumer protections are maybe seen as insufficient.
Prompting a call for federal action?
Exactly. Prompting this call for federal intervention. The bill frames the issue not just as a simple landlord-tenant dispute, but as a broader matter of market regulation and consumer protection against the profit maximization strategies of these large corporate entities.
It really highlights how these broader economic trends, like the financialization of assets, can have a very direct, sometimes devastating impact on specific vulnerable communities, bringing a local human issue all the way up to the federal legislative agenda. Okay, let's turn to the third branch. The judicial branch was also active on August 12th, not through major rulings handed down that day, but by setting the agenda for its upcoming term and through the ongoing evolution of legal strategy in the federal courts.
That's right. On August 12th, the Supreme Court of the United States released its oral argument calendars for the upcoming October and November 2025 sessions.
Which gives us a preview of what's coming.
A crystal clear preview, yeah. Of the major legal and constitutional questions the court intends to tackle in the coming term. The docket includes a number of cases with the potential for truly far-reaching impacts on American law and society.
So the court is signaling where the big legal battles will be fought.
Precisely. The selection of these specific cases ensures the judiciary will remain a central arena for national debate on really contentious issues. The court's eventual rulings could significantly reshape the legal landscape for elections, civil rights, criminal justice, the separation of powers, you name it. This announcement serves as a critical leading indicator of the legal and political fault lines that will define the coming year.
So what are some of these key cases on the Supreme Court's fall 2025 calendar that we and you listening should really be watching for? What's at stake?
Okay, several really stand out. On October 15th, the court is set to hear Louisiana v. Calais. This case asks whether a congressional map that includes a second majority black district created specifically to comply with the Voting Rights Act actually violates the Constitution.
That sounds huge for voting rights.
It has the potential to fundamentally re-examine the constitutionality of VRA Section 2 that could profoundly impact minority representation and voting rights across the entire country. Huge stakes.
What else?
Also on October 7th, there's Childs v. Salazar. This one examines whether a state's ban on conversion therapy for LGBTQ plus individuals violates the First Amendment rights of the therapist providing it.
So free speech versus state regulation and LGBTQ plus rights.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It delves right into that intersection. Significant implications for mental health practices, personal freedoms, religious freedom claims. Also on October 7th, Barrett v. United States. This tackles whether the Constitution's double jeopardy clause prohibits separate sentences for, say, using a gun during a violent crime, and for the underlying violent crime itself, like murder, could reshape sentencing.
And there are more cases related to elections and criminal justice too, right? The court seems to be loading up for a very impactful term.
Absolutely loaded. On October 8th, they'll hear Boast v. Illinois Board of Elections. This asks whether litigants, including a sitting member of Congress, even have legal standing, the right to sue to challenge state laws about counting mail-in ballots.
Which could affect future election challenges.
Profoundly. Affect how future challenges to state election procedures are even brought. And then on November 12th, Rutherford v. United States. This considers whether federal courts can look at non-retroactive changes in criminal law made under the First Step Act as extraordinary and compelling reasons to grant a sentence reduction. Impacts federal sentencing guidelines, ability of inmates to seek relief under recent reforms. These cases, yeah, they're set to ignite some huge legal battles.
Okay, beyond the Supreme Court's upcoming calendar, August 12th also highlighted a significant ongoing evolution in the legal landscape, specifically regarding injunctions and federal court rules influenced by recent Supreme Court decisions. It sounds like the way federal policies get challenged is fundamentally changing.
It truly is. An analysis published on Scotus' blog really highlighted this strategic shift in litigation against administration policies. It follows the court's recent landmark ruling in Trump v. Casa.
Remind us what Trump v. Casa decided.
In that case, the court held that broad, nationwide or universal injunctions issued by a single district court judge to block a federal policy across the entire country are generally unlawful.
That was a huge deal. It took away a major tool used by opponents of executive actions.
One of those powerful and often controversial tools, yes. It allowed one judge anywhere in the country to halt a policy for everyone. That's largely gone now.
So if universal injunctions are mostly off the table, what are litigants and advocacy groups doing now to challenge these federal policies? How are they adapting their strategy?
They're adapting. In response, litigants are shifting towards using class action lawsuits as a substitute.
Class actions instead of universal injunctions.
Right. The Supreme Court itself actually suggested this alternative mechanism in the Chassé opinion as a lawful way to grant relief to people not directly party to the suit. So now, class actions are becoming the primary vehicle for challenging broad administration policies.
How does that change things practically?
This procedural evolution is highly significant. Think about it. A universal injunction halted a policy for everyone, everywhere. An injunction in a class action lawsuit, however, only blocks the policy's application to the members of the specific certified class.
Which might not be everyone affected.
Exactly. It might be a large group, but maybe only people in certain states or certain situations.
This sounds like it could create a really fragmented and complex legal landscape, almost like a patchwork quilt of rules depending on where you are or who you are.
That's a perfect analogy. This tactical shift is likely to lead to a more fragmented, more intricate legal battlefield. You could have an executive policy enjoined, blocked, for a specific group of people in one judicial circuit, while it remains fully in effect for others across the country.
Leading to confusion and more lawsuits.
Leading to a patchwork of implementation, definitely spurring further litigation just to define the scope and membership of various classes. The Casehead decision, therefore, didn't end legal challenges to executive power. It just altered their form, making them potentially more protracted, more intricate, demanding new strategies from both the government and its challengers. Understanding federal policy now requires even more nuanced legal interpretation because of this.
So the legal battleground is indeed shifting, promising even more complexity in how federal policies are challenged and implemented across the country. A fascinating, if somewhat daunting, prospect for sure.
Okay, so looking back at August 12, 2025, it was truly a day that encapsulated the core tenets of this administration's approach to governance. When you view that flurry of activity across the executive branch holistically, you see a government acting with a high degree of strategic coherence, advancing a distinct nationalist and populist agenda, both here at home and abroad.
It really does show how all those instruments of national power, diplomacy, economic leverage, military tech, domestic legal authority, they were all deployed in a highly coordinated fashion, aiming for specific, interconnected objectives. But as we discuss, there were also some very clear tensions and contradictions embedded in that approach, weren't there?
Absolutely. You can't ignore the tensions. The day's events highlight several key ones inherent in this strategic posture.
For example?
Well, in foreign policy, you have the administration pursuing this high-stakes diplomatic opening with Russia, a primary adversary, while simultaneously punishing India, one of Russia's key economic partners, with tariffs. That creates a really complex, potentially contradictory set of incentives. It challenges traditional alliances.
And in economic policy.
There, it champions American industry through huge defense contracts. But at the same time, it fosters global trade uncertainty through the tactical, unpredictable use of tariffs. That potentially undermines the very stable supply chains those same industries rely on.
And domestically.
Domestically, it promotes a narrative of deregulation, free market principles, while simultaneously using the full force of federal regulatory power, like in banking, and law enforcement power, like the D.C. intervention, to intervene directly in local governance and protect its political allies. Mm-hmm. These aren't minor inconsistencies. They feel like fundamental tensions in the strategy.
So what does all this mean looking forward? What should we and you listening be watching for as these narratives and policies continue to develop?
Right, looking forward. The actions of August 12th have definitely set several critical developments in motion. Things that warrant close strategic monitoring. First, obviously, the outcome of the Trump-Putin summit. That will have profound implications for the war in Ukraine, certainly, but also for the stability of the whole transatlantic alliance. It could reshape global power dynamics significantly.
What else?
Second, the application of those secondary sanctions on India. Will that escalate into a broader trade dispute? It could have significant consequences for the global economy and for the strategic alignment in the crucial Indo-Pacific region. Could it push India closer to other economic blocs? We need to watch that.
And in the military domain?
The successful deployment of NTS-3's revolutionary capabilities, that will undoubtedly accelerate the global race for space and electromagnetic spectrum superiority. It forces other nations, friends, and rivals to adapt their own defense strategies.
And finally, domestically.
Domestically, the administration's assertive use of executive orders on issues like banking, retirement funds, grants, combined with the Supreme Court's pending review of those foundational legal questions we talked about, voting rights, election law, First Amendment issues, that guarantees a continued period of intense political and legal conflict within the United States. Federalism, the separation of powers, they'll remain right at the forefront of the national debate.
It sounds like August 12th was far from just another Tuesday. It was a clear demonstration of a government actively, forcefully reshaping policy at home and abroad, willing to challenge established norms, embrace a more unilateral transactional approach.
A very clear demonstration.
These are big, complex stories, and they are clearly only just beginning to unfold. Definitely something for you to mull over, explore further on your own as these intricate webs of decisions continue to impact our world. #TagTagTagVisaMyAttachment.
And that's our deep dive into the federal news update for Wednesday, August 13th, 2025. We hope this thorough exploration helped you feel more informed, maybe more connected to the intricate workings of the government and, you know, the forces shaping our world.
For more deep dives into complex topics like this, and to help cut through the noise, make sure you're subscribed. We'll see you next time.